It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report from the World Health Organization shows that one person around the world dies every 10 seconds from alcohol-related causes.
First, for many American families today, being middle class, usually the mark of stability, can mean living close to the financial edge. With stalling wages and mounting expenses, living paycheck to paycheck is part of the new experience of life in the middle class for some people.
But how is Wisconsin faring, and how are you doing? According to our guest, national trends suggest rising income insecurity is tied to getting and keeping a good-paying job and paying for high-quality goods and services. We want to hear from you. Are you feeling less financially secure? Does being in the middle class mean you have a solid financial footing for your family? Or are you living paycheck to paycheck, even with one or even two good-paying jobs? Call in, share your story, your experience at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joseph Cohen joins us now. He's assistant professor of sociology at Queens College in City University of New York. Joseph, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Joe, what are you seeing when you look at the issue of income insecurity in the middle class?
Well, it looks like over the past 30 years, there's been a long-term decrease in financial security, and we can see it in a lot of ways. In the early 1980s and during the 1970s, people saved maybe 10 to 13% of their take-home pay. That's dropped by half. It got down to 1% right before the crisis. People have very little money in their bank accounts and are unable to deal with, a financial emergency, a big bill, a medical emergency. They're deeply in debt. Bankruptcy had been rising steadily, and people are desperately undersaved for retirement.
And when we talk about families who seem to be solidly in the middle class, maybe you've got a couple each making about $45,000 a year, and that's what financial stability would seem to indicate financial stability. What does it look like now on an income like that?
Well, you mean for $90,000 total?
Right, as an example of a couple who seems to be doing pretty well, pulling in decent money, are they able to hit some of the benchmarks of stability that we might have expected in the past?
It is possible. The main problem is that there are certain sort of well-being essential goods and services that are very, very expensive. And if, for example, college or housing in a high-performing school district or maybe a non-distressed school district, childcare, things like that. Families, even families with good incomes, $90,000 will probably go a long way. But somebody who's maybe earning 50, 75, maybe around the median to the 75th percentile, can have trouble. People have to give up something. Do you want to live in a good school district? Do you want to pay for your child's college? Do you want to retire and not want to rely on Social Security exclusively?
So what kinds of things would you expect people to be able to do if they were income secure?
If they were income secure, for example, well, you can take a look at what happens in other highly developed countries like in Europe or Canada. A medical event might not push them over the financial precipice into bankruptcy, or college might be affordable enough that a young person doesn't have a home mortgage worth of debt before they even start earning. There are certain things that can wipe a family out, and the problem's compounded by the fact that people have very little cash on hand. They have a quarter of the country has about $500 in the bank, which is about two tire blowouts could wipe them out, and about 60% have less than $3,000 a medical bill. And that pushes people to assume debt or maybe liquidate assets if they run into a temporary job loss, a sickness, a major home repair.
I'm wondering about the expectations that people have for the middle class now. A generation ago, you might have expected that one partner could stay at home, raise the children if there were any. There would be enough for summer vacations and maybe a little vacation house somewhere if it was somewhere modest. Is that the same sort of thing people expect today?
I think people expect it. Well, in a way they expect it, and in a way they don't. There's some indication that people's expectations of their lifestyle or overall well-being is actually diminishing. People are beginning to expect that they'll be poorer in the future. And your question touches on maybe a core issue when we're talking about whether or not people are financially secure, because The truth is it's possible to literally survive easily on $90,000. It's possible to literally survive on $15,000 per year without outside help. But that means getting a basic number of calories, remaining clothed, and living indoors. When we talk about economic security or financial stability, we're asking how much money do you need to maintain what you'd consider a reasonable basic standard of living, given that we live in a very rich country in the year 2014? So do you need preventative medical care? Some people do without that. Do you need to live in a city whose murder rates aren't comparable to a major Brazilian or Mexican city? A lot of Americans live in that type of community. Do you need your children to go to a school district that would be considered average by, Hungarian, Polish, or Slovakian standards? Forget about Canada, Britain, or Sweden. So the question is how much people feel they need, and in other countries, things like preventative medical care or affordable college or even childcare are considered rights or things that, it's undisputable that everybody in society needs them. And so they're provided at a heavily subsidized cost or in some situations, no cost. And the problem is in the United States, there's a large out-of-pocket burden. So if you run out of money, you run a risk of having to forego something that you really need, like a medical procedure. Or you might have to settle for sending your child to a distressed school district that would be right at the bottom of global rankings.
Well, and not every state is being affected in the same way. Not every city. In some of the states with the worst income instability for the middle class, what are we seeing there?
Well, poverty is very, very high. There's all sorts of different problems going on in different parts of the country. So, there are certain parts, certain states, and certain communities where people are desperately poor, and they are living, I'd say, a material standard of living that, when foreigners look at it, they might consider it to be intolerable or unacceptable. Wisconsin, apparently, I was looking into the data in anticipation of this interview, and it appears that Wisconsin is actually nationally one of the better places to stay afloat. So the pressures that face a lot of Americans might not be felt as hard by people in Wisconsin.
And what do you attribute that to?
Well, it's hard to say. I'm not an expert on what happens in Wisconsin. I know it appears that housing is very, very affordable, and that's a pressure that people in the coastal states don't have to contend with. And housing is one of the four major drains on people's budgets. The others are healthcare, education, and transportation costs. There are plenty of places where housing is cheap, but there are no jobs. And Wisconsin seems to be doing okay in that respect. Its wages are around the national average, even though it has low housing values. And that's probably a big factor. The other thing is, it looks like just from the data that the public transportation system isn't too bad either. There's very few people who appear to be left unconnected by the system, and transportation can be a problem.
Well, let's talk about income stagnation for a moment. Wage stagnation, is that a national trend? Because if so, would that be affecting people here in Wisconsin as well? Given that in a field of their peers, Wisconsin might look pretty good.
Right. Well, that's it. It's good. It's good for America. For international standards, I don't know. But the truth is that people all over the world have to deal with some type of pressure, and a lot of it has to do with globalization and technology. Those are international pressures that everybody and everywhere is having to contend with. In the United States, there are some other sort of factors that compound those two difficulties. So the social safety net is a little bit thinner. Taxes don't redistribute as much wealth as in other countries. The social policy doesn't really buffer people in the same way that it would, in Northern Europe or to some degree even in Canada or Britain.
Well, we're talking right now about income insecurity in the middle class and taking a snapshot of what middle class living looks like here in Wisconsin. Our guest is Joseph Cohen, assistant professor of sociology at Queens College in the City University of New York. We're talking about income insecurity in the middle class and trying to get a sense of what it feels like here in Wisconsin. Are you feeling a middle class squeeze, which has been the national trend? Are you foregoing things, maybe preventative health care, those tires on the car, that kind of thing? Or do you feel like, as someone in the middle class, you're doing pretty well here in Wisconsin?
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your stories. Do you feel economically insecure? What's driving that? What would it take to make you feel like you're on solid ground again? Or for the first time ever, maybe. Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we've got a comment here. Marsha on Facebook says, "My husband is a full-time teacher. I'm only able to work part-time. We're definitely feeling the squeeze due to his union being rendered impotent. Health insurance became more expensive 2 years ago, and our deductible went up. Our copay doubled this year. We eat out much less often than we did 4 years ago. We rarely buy clothes brand new anymore. And while I never used to check prices at the supermarket, I now absolutely must." That from Marsha. And Joe, what does that say to you about how Wisconsin, or at least some people, are faring right now?
Well, that experience it seems quite typical. We often think of people who are experiencing financial distresses, imprudent spenders, just sort of consumerists who buy things that they don't need and generally waste their money. But the data shows that over the past 30 years, Americans have been spending less money on, you know, groceries, on restaurants, on clothing, and things like that. It's those four big areas: education, which includes childcare, healthcare, housing, and transportation costs that are putting the squeeze on people. And housing is a particularly burdensome cost, and is really the source of people's debt. And there's an interesting sort of aspect of America, how America organizes its school system. For example, in Ontario, where I'm from, people pay taxes to the province, and then the province distributes money on a reasonably equitable per student basis, and they give supplemental funding to poor neighborhoods. And what that means is that you can live below your means. There's no sort of educational penalty to living in a poor neighborhood. The problem in a lot of U.S. states is that schools are funded locally, and so ability to get a foothold in one of those well-heeled neighborhoods means that you can send your kid to a school that's well-funded. And those well-heeled neighborhoods tend to restrict the development of high-density housing that could, a place that people of more modest means could afford, or that the middle class could just sort of downgrade their lifestyle, spend below their means, and live there. A good example of that, I was looking at educational scores I don't have firsthand experience with Wisconsin, but for example, in Milwaukee, in downtown Milwaukee, there's very, very inexpensive housing, and the school system performs very low relative to other highly developed countries, including poor ones like in Eastern Europe. Whereas if you go to the western suburbs of Milwaukee, like Pewaukee and places like that, you get world-class schools, but the housing is four or five times more expensive, and it's less densely populated.
So there are these trade-offs that are happening there. Let's go to the phones right now. We've got Jim joining us now in Fontana. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
I'd like to speak a little bit from the point of view of a senior citizen, and my wife is retired. I'm still working. In terms of dropping the middle class, of course we're dropping the middle class. I went to the University of Illinois in the 60s for $135 a semester tuition, so I got a great start. But I'm kind of wondering, we seem so obsessed with the middle class. For instance, if you're making a little bit more money and you're kind of back in the upper middle class, you feel good driving to a little better restaurant that you can now afford through a neighborhood where people are really suffering. There's a mean, you're in the solid middle class, you get to have one or two speedboats instead of one. I'd like to see us take care of each other, you know, get housing taken care of, good education, good health care. And then we really need so much stuff. We really doesn't matter where in the middle class we are. How about the idea of community and a and a society that's healthy all the way through, top to bottom. That would be my comment.
Gotcha, Jim. Thank you for that. And Jim's saying maybe spread the bounty a little bit among the middle class and have people helping out each other, and probably society-wide, I'm guessing he's saying. What do you think about that sort of idea, Joseph?
Well, you know, I know it's sort of a contentious, the idea of redistribution or spending the wealth, spreading the wealth. It's politically a hot button issue. I would say that in other highly developed countries, at the very least, we can ensure that people can get sort of the very basics, things that they need to stay healthy, physically secure, and economically viable. If we could just make those things inexpensive, I think that would take a lot of the burden off of people's need to accumulate so much money. My impression, I've been in America 14 years now, and from the outside, it's often thought that there's a money-oriented culture. But I find that Americans are not like that at all. It's that you need a lot of money to ensure that if you lose your job, you can still make COBRA payments and cover the doctor. Or if you have a child who you want to go to college, you can make sure that they don't start life out in a mountain of debt. And if we could just eliminate sort of those basic well-being financial obligations and make it a matter of a nice restaurant or, you know, things like that, I think that all Americans' standards of living would be higher.
Well, thanks a lot for the call, Jim. And we're going to move next to Nick in Hudson. Hi, Nick.
Hi. I was listening to this on the radio, and I heard about the middle class. And being someone who's grown up in the middle class for pretty much his whole life, I see that one of the biggest issues is now I'm in college now, and in order to get in and stay into the middle class, you need to get a college degree. And we're seeing, especially in the state of Wisconsin, we're seeing rising tuition costs. And while the tuition freeze in the past years has helped us out, it's also hurting some of the schools because we're seeing the ones that did budget effectively didn't have problems with this large surplus of money are not able to keep the good teachers because we just simply don't have the money. We don't have the students. And I think that if we really want to keep the middle class, we should keep working towards this idea of having a state-based education, and maybe we can get jobs that would promote middle class, keep the middle class going in Wisconsin.
All right. Thanks a lot, Nick. Thanks for your thoughts. And Joe, getting at the place college has in all this. Now, it used to be college was your ticket out of poverty, if you were in poverty, into the middle class. And where does that stand now?
The returns to college appear to be diminishing over the long term. So it is losing its cachet and, in effect, almost becoming the new high school, at least over the long term. Still, a lot of people don't go to college, and there are definite benefits to doing it. It's just that the advantage is eroding. And even public education here is very, very expensive. I think it's about $9,000 at the University of Wisconsin. At the University of Toronto, be about $6,000. And in Europe, there's many countries like the French and the Dutch have a tuition-free college. It's treated just the way high school is or elementary school is.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for that call, Nick. And just where do you see this going in terms of the income insecurity for the middle class? This has been sort of a big talking point for both political parties as we head into the election season, into the midterms, talking about the middle class and where they are now. But where do you see the wind blowing?
Well, there are some bright spots, and there's also some degree of hopelessness on my part, or maybe skepticism. There are certain things. I believe that the Affordable Care Act has the possibility of defraying some of the health care costs, but it's hard to envision getting down to the point where people don't have to worry about medical bills like they do in other places. College continues to be more expensive, and it's not altogether clear why it's becoming more expensive, but that's spiraling out of control. And it's very difficult to envision a situation in which sort of the well-heeled neighborhoods would be opening their doors to more affordable housing or, you know, more school integration. It just seems that people have too much to lose. And part of the problem is that I get the sense that everybody's desperate in some way. Everybody wants to hold on to whatever sliver of security they have or whatever sliver of advantage that they can retain so that their children can hopefully stay above water in a future that's undoubtedly going to be more and more competitive and tougher to survive. So I'm skeptical that there'd be changes that would ease these pressures. But who knows?
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Joe, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Joseph Cohen, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Queens College in the City University of New York. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll check in with the Discover magazine editor about this month's top stories from the world of science.
First, around the world, someone dies of an alcohol-related death every 10 seconds. That's 3.3 million deaths annually, according to a new report out today from the World Health Organization on the health risks of alcohol consumption.
While addiction is oftentimes the biggest concern, when assessing the risks of alcohol, there are about 200 diseases associated with alcohol consumption, including liver cirrhosis and some forms of cancer.
Well, the report looks at the problem globally. It is an issue in particular with relevance to Wisconsin. Here in Wisconsin, we have the highest rate of binge drinking, according to the Centers for Disease Control, and general alcohol consumption is 30% higher than the rest of the country.
The economic cost here in Wisconsin comes out to about $6.9 billion a year, according to a recent study from the UW Population Health Institute. Here with us to discuss the public health impact of our heavy alcohol consumption is Maureen Buzalaki. She's Executive Director of Health First Wisconsin. Maureen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this was an international report. A global report shows about half of the world's population drinks alcohol, averaging about 17 liters of pure alcohol a year. Roughly how much do we consume here in Wisconsin by comparison?
Well, our consumption rate is above both the national and international averages. For binge drinking, we're at about 23% of the population. And I believe internationally it's 16. So, you know, major, you know, difference. And our annual alcohol consumption is about 28% higher than the national average.
What are some of the biggest health consequences we see related to alcohol here in the state?
Well, you know, obviously there's death that happens from a variety of things between accidents, as well as you mentioned health conditions. There's a lot of hospitalizations related to alcohol. And I mean, not, you know, having a glass of wine with dinner. We're talking about excessive alcohol consumption. Of course, a lot of folks have to go to treatment. There's a lot of arrests that are associated with alcohol and, of course, motor vehicle crashes.
What kind of toll economically? We mentioned that dollar figure from the Population Health Institute. How big a problem is this for our state's economy?
I think it's a pretty big problem. We've got an estimated almost $3 billion in lost productivity. So folks who aren't able to perform their jobs or they become disabled or unable to do their jobs prematurely. There's another $2 billion dollars in premature deaths, about $750 million in health care, and then you've got, you know, the criminal justice system, motor vehicle, human services. So, you know, it definitely takes a toll. In terms of taxpayers, we pay about $2.9 billion due to excessive consumption of alcohol.
The World Health Organization in that report is looking for a 10% reduction in harmful alcohol use by 2025. I want to talk about some of the specific things you're looking for here in Wisconsin. And let's start with the binge drinking you mentioned earlier. We're well above the national average there. What do you see as the best ways to target binge drinking in the state?
Well, we have an environment here in Wisconsin that encourages people to overconsume. So if you look at how many alcohol outlets we have compared, you know, both nationally and internationally, we're way out of bounds in terms of the number of places you can buy alcohol and the number of places you can consume alcohol in. So that's certainly something that local communities can be looking at. We also think it would be important that we change our laws so that if you're under the age of 21, you can't drink in public, so you can't be drinking, you know, at the bar when mom and dad are buying, you know, alcohol. A lot of restaurants and bars don't do that anyway, but I think it's important to set the norm so that we're making sure we're setting sort of the culture that it's not okay for kids to drink.
On a related note, while I was driving around the state, I saw a lot of communities had signs this weekend about parents hosting parties where teens drink. How important is that as part of the anti-health risks of alcohol effort?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all know that certain seasons tend to, you know, we hate opening the paper and finding out that a carload of teenagers were killed because they were drinking at prom or graduation. And so a lot of communities have taken a concerted effort to make sure parents understand the risk. And I think almost 40 communities have passed laws that say if it's your property, you're also liable. So not only can you not supply alcohol to kids, especially kids not your own children, but that, you know, providing a place for them is also against the law. I think, you know, in Wisconsin we have this sort of rite of passage, you know, everyone will be okay, we went through it. But I think the research has really shown that alcohol on a kid's brain is pretty dangerous. And we know in athletics that it takes quite a while for kids to have their brains actually return to normal after a binge drinking episode, which is why we find a lot of injuries on Mondays and Tuesdays after binge drinking on Saturdays.
With smoking, it seemed like a lot of the effort was concentrated among younger teens through high school, the idea being that if you can get them to not start smoking at that age, you're in good shape for the rest of their lives. Is there an age range that you're particularly targeting with the alcohol message?
Really, it's very similar. If you can keep alcohol out of a child's brain until they're 21, their chances of having an alcohol disorder go way, way, way down. And it has to do with the brain development. So it's important to keep that in mind as parents. And I think as we learn more and more about how alcohol impacts a child's brain, we, you know, will hopefully change our culture a bit so that we are supporting each other in that. And that, you know, teenagers are going to do risky things, but we need to do our best to prevent that and make it as safe as possible.
If you had a message for parents out there of kids in the tween through teen, maybe even into college age, what would that message be?
I think talk to your kids about this issue. I know it's a difficult kind of thing, but I think it's really important. And pay attention to what's happening in your community. We find that kids often mimic what their parents do. And, you know, it's important to make sure that they understand that it's really not okay to do the same things when they're under 21. There's really, there is a scientific reason why you have the age of 21 for drinking, because of the brain development. Now, granted, everyone's brain is a slightly different rate than that, but that's a great place to aim for.
Maureen, you and others have been sounding the alarm about binge drinking, drunken driving in Wisconsin for a while, and talking about our alcohol culture. Are people listening to the message? Are we starting to take this seriously?
I think a lot of folks are quite concerned about it. But I think there's a lot more that we can do. The legislature, you know, only passed one out of the 7 bills they were presented with this session. They didn't even really discuss sobriety checkpoints, which is known to be a great way to prevent drunk driving. So I think we have a long way to go in terms of taking it seriously on the state level. However, in the local communities, we're seeing a lot of change going on with athletic codes changing so that kids can't even be seen at parties where alcohol is served, to the social host ordinances, which I referred to earlier. And another piece is a number of communities are really looking at their alcohol density and trying to work through that, you know, maybe not every business needs to have an alcohol license to operate well in Wisconsin.
We'll leave it there for now. Maureen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Maureen Buzalaki. She's Executive Director of Health First Wisconsin. The World Health Organization released a report today detailing that 3.3 million people around the world die annually from alcohol-related deaths. The June issue of Discover Magazine hits newsstands tomorrow, which means we have Gemma Tarlak back with us to preview some of the month's coolest science stories.
Gemma is Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about the top science news. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Always great to be talking to you.
Well, you cover this month a really fascinating story about a solar-powered plane. And it kind of seems like a tall order to power this highly complex machine, an airplane, via solar power. How does it work?
Well, the Solar Impulse 2, it's actually kind of the sequel to the original that they crossed the country with last year. This is going to be the first round-the-world flight, and they're testing it now for a 2015 flight. But basically, they worked on making it very, very light with a huge wingspan. For example, the wingspan is longer than a 747, and the plane weighs less than a Ford Expedition, which is a pretty impressive combo of stats. But it's really slow. A Greyhound could outrun it. It's got a top speed of about 40 miles an hour, and a Greyhound, I think, tops out around 45 miles an hour. So it's a combination of a super light materials, super big, long wingspan, and just kind of harnessing technology in a way that's never been attempted before.
Okay, the dumb question maybe that pops into my head right away is, you're flying around the world, you're up in the air, and the sun goes down, or a cloud goes up. I assume they don't come immediately plummeting to the ground. Why not?
It would be a very, very short test flight they did last year if that were the case. No, they have all kinds of workarounds, and they're actually going to do the flight over a 3 to 4 month period in sort of short stages. And, you know, there'll be the two test pilots doing this. They are the first to say, no, this is not going to be the way commercial solar flight is going to work. This is just a prototype, just kind of proof of concept showing people that it can be done. And once they do it, they're going to work on designing something that's a little more, I would say, realistic as a mode of transportation. But it's so exciting to think, you know, the sun is there. Why not use it for energy?
So is that the ultimate goal, though, having a passenger plane with more than one person in it?
Well, I think that is the ultimate goal. Right now, they're just concerned about actually getting this thing off the ground and around the world without incident. Our writer covered this. She opens up the story with this great description of how the wing, an early prototype of it, just kind of cracked under the pressure. And, you know, it's very much in its infant stages. And we'll see where it goes.
Well, another story you have this month, an interview with a molecular biologist. This blew my mind a little bit, who studies how bacteria can talk to each other, kind of an oh-no moment for humanity. What is bacterial communication? How do we know what they're saying to each other?
You know, I have to tell you, when one of the editors first brought this story up and we started talking about it, everybody, I think, in the room got a chill because it's like, wait, bacteria communicate and they plan actions? Oh, this is great. But yeah, it's something bacteria have been doing for 4 billion years. They communicate using chemical language. So they're not actually, you know, sidling up to each other and saying, hey, Bob, how you doing? They're actually, though, communicating through chemicals, through these three different molecules they've identified so far. There may be more, but they do something called quorum sensing. You know, if you have some random lone bacterium floating around your body, you're going to be okay. But if you have enough to obtain a quorum, they can actually decide to attack you in mass when they realize, hey, we've got enough of us to gang up on this host organism. And again, they do that through chemical signals between these molecules. What really blew my mind when we were talking about the story was that bacteria can actually identify each other within a species, and they can also communicate across species. So if you have, you know, a random bacterium of cholera floating around and it meets up with a random bacteria of E. coli, they can pretty much chemically say to each other, hey, I'm cholera. And the other one will be like, hey, I'm E. coli. Now, if that is not terrifying, I don't know what is.
That sounds like the worst party mixer ever in your body. I don't know. Like,
I've been to that party.
I join with Rob on this. This did kind of freak me out a little bit. So these bacteria can coordinate their actions. So I guess the idea being that they get a quorum and then suddenly they can instigate a disease in your body. So what are scientists going to do with this very freaky information now that we have it?
Well, that's right. I mean, that's when really the infection starts, when they achieve their quorum and they do something called auto-induce, and they do whatever naughty business they're going to do, whether it's attacking your body or, you know, not all bacteria are bad. Some of them are just like bioluminescent. So when they reach their quorum, they just glow, which is awful nice. But anyway, bacteria in general, they call this communication chatter. And what they're trying to do is basically shut them up to find ways of working with these molecules, sending out the chemical signals, to shut them down. And maybe they send out the signal, but it's not understood. So the bacteria never realize that there are enough, that they've achieved a quorum and could attack. There are all different ways that they're trying to shut them down. But it's basically shutting down the chat room.
And you mentioned bacteria have been doing this for 4 billion years or so. This is new to us and new to the world of science, isn't it?
Yeah, the field is only about 20 or 30 years, and it's really only, I would say, in the last 10 to 15 years that they're actually identifying these molecules, zeroing in on how they communicate and also how they could potentially shut them down.
And that bioluminescent bacteria you mentioned, that was one of our first hints, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. This is actually way back in the 70s. They started to notice that just a couple of random bacteria floating in the petri dish didn't do anything, but once they achieved their quorum, boom, they all lit up. And that's really where the research started.
So just to put it into context, or to give us a silver lining on this parcel of what seems like it's sort of bad news, is what are some of the key diseases that could possibly be interrupted and halted if we figure out how to manipulate the bacteria quorum?
Well, the good/creepy thing is that all bacteria appear to have this ability to communicate. So any disease, any kind of infection that is bacterially induced, we have the potential, once we figure out how to shut them up, we have the potential to treat. The example the researcher Bonnie Bassler cited was Pseudomonas, which can be fatal, especially to someone with, say, cystic fibrosis. And if you can figure out a way to shut that down, chances are you're going to figure out a way to stop the chatter for a lot of other bacteria as well. It's pretty exciting.
Well, I'd like to be the first to welcome our new bacterial overlords. I want to move on to one more story, though. And this one's a fun one, a new kind of soccer ball. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I love this story. There's this company in New York called Uncharted Play, and they came up with the Socket. It has two C's. And it is a soccer ball for all intents and purposes. Looks like a normal soccer ball. It's about 2 ounces heavier, but inside it has this whole kinetic energy mechanism that every time you kick it, every time it flies through the air, it is generating energy that is stored internally. And then after you play for 30 minutes, you can plug in a lamp, plug in your cell phone to charge, and you get 3 hours of power. And they designed this specifically for kids in the developing world because, you know, a lot of they don't have access to electricity. So when it's time to do homework, if the sun is down, what are they going to do? So the idea is they take the ball out, they play with it, kick it around for a while, come back in, plug in their light, plug the light into the socket, and then they can do their homework. Or, you know, their parents can cook or whatever they need the electricity for. They can actually use it.
So is this technology that will be priced excessively to people in the developing world?
Well, what they're doing right now, and this is the very early stages, it just came on the market, they're selling them in the developed world for about $100. But when you order it, every time you order it, they identify a child in a developing world country, and they put them on what they call a socket team. And once they get 5 kids, in other words, once one of us lucky folks in the developed world buys a socket, when you get 5 kids, they actually give them a socket ball. So right now, children in the developing world are not having to pay for them. And I think they're trying to keep that, obviously as accessible and as affordable as possible.
And they found, I gather, that in some countries, soccer is a boy sport, not in others, obviously. What do they do for girls in those countries?
Yeah, I love this. When they were doing their test trials of the early versions, they noticed the girls never were playing soccer, but they were jumping rope. So they designed something called the Pulse. It's a jump rope. It uses very similar technology. And again, every time the rope turns, it's generating energy that is stored. And then you just plug in your USB right into the jump rope handles, and you can, again, charge your phone, use a light, all different applications.
Now, as a soccer ball goes or a jump rope goes, are these actually decent, bits of play equipment? Can you play a decent game of soccer with the socket?
Yeah, in fact, the socket is actually rougher and tougher than a normal soccer ball that's just inflatable, because normal inflatable balls, they only last a few weeks and then they go to the landfill because you can't really repair them after a time. The socket is designed to last 3 years. It has a really tough outer shell that stands up to all the kicking and all the rough ground that a lot of these playing fields are on. And it's also designed to be repaired using super basic parts. So, if it's off in Africa or in India or somewhere and it breaks, they don't have to send it back to the manufacturer to get the super special part. They can just kind of jerry-rig it to work.
Gemma, did you get to play with either of these, the socket or the pulse?
No, I didn't. Oh. And I'm so mad about that.
Well, think of harnessing the energy of children. Talk about a renewable.
Right.
I mean, they have a lot of energy, in my experience. This could be a good solution to a lot of problems.
It's a win-win situation, you know. The children get some exercise, get out in the fresh air, and then they have no excuse not to do their homework.
All right. We'll leave it there. Thank you so much, as always, for being with us, Gemma.
Always great. Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine. Based in Waukesha, she joins us each month with some of the coolest stories from the worlds of science and technology.